This is the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this show, following the distressing events to come out of America in recent days, we speak to the Board of Deputies' Phil Rosenberg, as well as motivational speaker Jodeci Joseph about his personal experiences towards the issues surrounding the protests we're witnessing. It's no secret that now that the Jewish News' 40 Under 40 top 10 has been revealed, we'll speak to number three. That's Danny Stone, chief executive of Anti-Semitism Policy Trust. We have not one, but two COVID-19 heroes this week. Katie Icklow is part of a team that has been awarded a prestigious Points of Light Award by Boris Johnson for her work in providing meals to NHS staff. And we also meet Amir Hamarati from Spark Beyond about the extraordinary work that his organisation have been doing in a bid to fight the coronavirus. That is not to be missed, trust me. Oh, and as if all of that isn't enough, we'll continue our new feature where comedian Ashley Blaker will give us some wise words in these troubled times. But before all of that, welcome along to this episode of the JN Podcast, and let's start off, as we plan to each week here, with a look at your copy of the Jewish News. Joining me to go through it is news editor Justin Cohen and features editor Fran Wolfish. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Right, let us start off with a glance over the front page. And Justin, it's a very busy front page today. I think we're going to talk about all the stories on there. Where do you want to start?
I think really there is only one place to start this week in the world when it comes to news, and that is the killing in Minnesota of George Floyd. We have run a front page this week with a headline that Derek Chauvin lent on us too, lent on us all. And really, I want to address that because that has raised a few eyebrows in the community. Are we trying to somehow make this artificially a Jewish story? Are we trying to claim the pain of the black community? I hope it's clear to anyone who actually reads the content of our front page opinion article that that's not at all the case, that we are absolutely recognizing the unique position of the black community and the racism that it continues to feel, not just in America, but here as well. But at the same time, Jewish people do react in a certain visceral way to any signs of racism. And they feel that acutely. And I think they want to address any signs of racism as a result of our own past experiences. And it was that we were trying to reflect. And I think that the community this week, the community leadership, has reacted very, very strongly. Statements from the CST, from the United Synagogue, from all sorts of organizations speaking in the strongest possible terms. But also the chief rabbi, just after we went to press, released a statement saying that the chorus of shock and anger at this point can't just be that. It can't just be a short-term thing, that we have to act beyond this. We have to show we've learned. We have to make an effort to bridge those gaps with the black community. And only then will it be possible to show that this, that some good, perhaps, has come out of this horrific incident. And I think there have been some good signs on that front from the UK Jewish community in the last few days. We've seen various organisations mobilising to reach out to both members of the community who are black. They are a visible minority within a minority, but one that we don't often, you know, hear about. We don't see very often at the forefront of the community, and perhaps it's about time we did more from now on.
Indeed, and we're going to find out more about that when we speak to one of the members from our community, Jodeci Joseph, later on in this program. And of course, Phil Rosenberg from the Board of Deputies will hear their thoughts a little later. I think it would be remiss to not mention that, of course, that there has been, of course, some ugliness to come out of this as well, which we mustn't dwell too much on, because obviously the hope is that only good will come out of a horrible situation. But the truth is that it undermines a lot of the arguments when you do see reports, and I have seen reports this week, that suggest that religious buildings, including synagogues, have been defaced in and amongst the protests. And of course, there is going to be an element of the community that is going to feel that as much as we side with anti-racism, it's going to be quite hard to overlook that that has happened.
There's definitely a sort of an element of, and I'm not going to beat around the bush here, thuggery who are attempting to sort of hijack the dialogue that's now going on about this issue. And really, I'm not going to spend any time talking about them. What I do want to talk about, though, is I wholeheartedly agree with the chief rabbi and his statement. I think he got it absolutely spot on. And what we should actually be doing now is using this time to be more introspective, actually, and to look at ourselves, look at our community. What more can we be doing? This can't just be about words, because words obviously are very powerful and can lead to good things, but we really need to take action right now. That's actually what needs to happen. We need to improve education. We need to build bridges. We need to improve tolerance and respect. And that's really what this is about. You know, we need to take the good lessons out of this issue and not focus on the bad.
One of the things I've been particularly conscious of over the last 2 days is how we have many events, and quite rightly, a great deal of effort goes in by community leadership to reaching out to other faith groups, particularly the Muslim community and the Christian communities. But when it comes to relations with the Black community, I mean, I don't recall any specific event that brought our two communities together in any tangible way. And certainly, I would hope, and indeed I hear, there are moves towards that happening now.
Interesting. Well, I dare say that we will find out more about it, as I mentioned later on in the programme. There are some other stories on the front page and, of course, into the papers as well. Let's delve in, and to page 10 we'll go straight away, where, Fran, you have been writing about your experience of your children, like many other Jewish pupils, heading back to school this week.
Yes, that's right. It was a very strange situation. 10 weeks ago, I turned up to collect my two children from primary school, as I normally did. And that was it. Well, it almost felt like that was it. That was the final day, that somehow 2020 had been completely scrapped and written off. And the next time that the children potentially might go back to school could be next year. It was a very strange feeling. I admit to feeling quite emotional about it. I have my youngest is in reception, and my daughter is in year four. And just the thought that they had lost out on, you know, their school experience, part of their childhood even. I don't want to be too dramatic about it, but I'm sure lots of parents had the same sort of feeling, that they'd almost been robbed a little bit in a way that we weren't when we were growing up. We went to school and, you know, we continued on and we had our summer holiday and went back into the next year, and suddenly our children weren't going to have that. So to finally be able to go back to school this week, while obviously in many ways I had all the anxiety that lots of other parents had about how safe it was and everything else, deep down I really felt that this was actually a really, really good thing for the children. They have missed out on routine. They've missed out really on a little bit of normality. And let's face it, we are not living in normal times. Adults are not living in normal times. So, you know, it's been hard for the children as well. They've not been able to see their friends. They've missed out socially. They've missed out academically. So to be able to even walk them back up to the school gates was an amazing thing. And I have to say, to my children's school's credit, they've really, like many other schools, have done all they can to ensure that the children are returning to a safe place. There's new systems for drop-off and collection. The teachers are wearing, you know, PPE. There's gloves and masks and aprons and all that kind of stuff going on. There's one-way systems within the school so that the children are socially distancing. And they've also been put into bubbles, small groups of around 10 to 15 children, to ensure that class sizes are smaller and that they are adhering as much as possible to this social distancing.
So the upshot is that there are many new things to get used to in the world of school, and that can be found in more detail on page 10 of this week's Jewish News. Just finally, let's have a look, as it's been revealed, the top 10 of the 40 under 40, which you've been counting down for the last few weeks.
Yeah, we're delighted to be able to reveal this list, a list which we hold every 5 years or thereabouts. And this year we've actually got someone who's not a communal professional as number one, and that is Johnny Benjamin, who will be familiar to listeners of this podcast as he edited the Jewish News a couple of weeks ago for Mental Health Awareness Week and appeared on the podcast at that point. And we've honoured him for his fantastic pioneering work that he does with organisations like Jamie and others to raise awareness of the issue of mental health within the community, to break down that taboo. Other people that we featured in the list include Claudia Mendoza, who is about to take over as the co-CEO of the Jewish Leadership Council. We've got Danny Stone from the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust, and he'll be appearing on the podcast later on. And also Rachel Riley, not often that we have a celebrity in the list, and certainly someone that wouldn't have anticipated being in the last list 5 years ago. Her appearance on the communal scene, of course, came about during the rise of anti-Semitism, during the Labour crisis on anti-Semitism, and we're delighted to be able to honour her for her work, and she's at number two.
I'll be delighted to say that after today, we can officially say that the top three have appeared in the first six episodes, one way or another, of the JN podcast. Sadly, both, I'm afraid that's where we have to leave it for a look at the paper for this week. Don't forget, you can pick up your copy of the Jewish News every Thursday. And don't forget, if you are isolating at the moment, the full paper can be found online at jewishnews.co.uk. But for now, news editor Justin Cohen, features editor Fran Wolfish, thank you both very much indeed.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
This is the JN podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, as we've been hearing already on this podcast, and of course, I'm sure through the media coverage that we have seen over the past few days, the community has reacted with equal shock to George Floyd's death and the subsequent protests and scenes that we have witnessed as a result of it. Let's look at this a little further with our first two guests for this edition of the JN podcast. We can speak to Phil Rosenberg of the Board of Deputies and Jadesi Joseph, who is a motivational speaker. Thank you both very much indeed for speaking to me. Jadesi, we'll come to you in just a moment's time. But Phil, let's start off with you when we talk a little bit about how the community has reacted to what is, whichever way you look at it, all round, a very sad story.
Yes, thank you very much, Phil. I mean, the community has been horrified by this because the incident, horrific in itself and so graphically shared on so many platforms, is a reminder of the violence that has been done to Black bodies over centuries. And not just about violence, which has been all too common, particularly in America, but also here in the UK, but also the discrimination that Black people face in everyday life, whether that's at the hands of police, but also in education, in employment, in health, as we've seen in the disproportionate deaths over coronavirus. And both as a community that unfortunately has experienced prejudice ourselves over the longest time, we have a sense of solidarity, but also as a community that has many people of colour in it, you know, we have to have that sense of empathy and solidarity. And I think what you've seen by rabbis, the chief rabbi, other rabbis, community leaders coming forward, is that we want to get this right. And I think there's a lot of people asking what to do, and I'd put it into three main buckets. First of all, we need to be absolutely clear and show solidarity with people who are facing this, the Black community particularly. Advocacy on issues that are important, and that includes policing, includes health, includes education. One of the things we've been working on is advocacy for a permanent memorial to the transatlantic slave trade, which is in many ways the original sin of the Northern Hemisphere against Black people. And then looking at self-improvement, because our own communities are not always perfect on these issues.
Well, it's certainly not, but I think that is the key here, is that no community is faultless in all of this. There are lots of people who are making noise and, shall we say, demonstrating the upper hand and getting on their high horse about it, but everyone has their faults. And Jadesi, I'm just wondering from your perspective, I need to make this very clear. I hate with an absolute passion labeling people. I don't like describing people based on the color of their skin. I don't like describing people on their religion. However, there is very much a reason that we are talking to you about this subject. But how would you feel comfortable about introducing yourself to explain why it is that you are a perfect individual to talk about this particular subject?
Yeah, sure. So thank you so much for that. My name is Jodeci Joseph. I'm a mixed race Jew. So my dad's Nigerian. My mum's from Hackney. So I'm mixed. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't know I was Jewish when I was 11, but over the last few years, I've really engrossed myself into North London, into the Jewish community as a whole. And to be honest, I have had many good experiences, but this issue of Black Lives Matter has really highlighted to me and made me reflect on my experiences in the Jewish community. Meaning there has been many times me attending synagogues, and being told I can't come in because I don't look Jewish, or they said I'm not Jewish, or questioning me so much because of the colour of my skin. I assumed it was the colour of my skin. On top of that, I go into synagogues for the first time and I get a lot of stares, which is also very uncomfortable. And I get people asking me very personal questions about my background and if I became Jewish at a certain point. And all of these kind of situations have made me feel that there's a lot of work to be done in the Jewish community.
I mean, Phil, how do you react to that? Because I have to tell you that just me listening to that, I know full well that the Jewish community is not faultless, as I've said already, but it just somehow, it feels even more wrong given all the persecution that our community has experienced ourselves over the centuries. Just how we could even in this day and age question someone entering a synagogue based on the color of their skin, and may I say allegedly, even though we've not necessarily mentioned any particular synagogues.
Well, I don't even need to say allegedly, because my wife happens to be black as well, a black Jew, and we've had exactly the same experiences of difficulties with security, the stares that Jadesi mentioned, the difficult questions. I think that's all absolutely true, and I don't need to say allegedly because I've seen it firsthand. And I think that we need to really think about this as a community. Some of our denominations have been quite intentional about thinking about how they can be more inclusive. Others need to do the work. But what I think we've seen in terms of the reaction from the community is that there is a willingness to learn. And I think that's the opportunity we need to take at this stage. We absolutely need to get this right, and we need to stop the experiences that people, that Jadesi and my wife Frances have had. And because it's wrong, it's shocking. And as you say, Phil, our own community needs to do better, because, not least because, we've had similar experiences ourselves.
Jadesi, what are those lessons that we need to learn? Because I don't know whether or not it's very easy, and yet obviously very difficult, for us to say that we need to stop judging someone based on the colour of their skin. But it goes so much deeper than that. And I'm just thinking that from your perspective, what is it that you would like to see people realise and ultimately change about their attitudes?
Obviously, it's completely irrational to be racist, because our skin is only 1% of our actual body, and it doesn't even matter because our personality is what makes us up. But in the Jewish community, we're not a race. We say we are a race, but we're also a religion, and anyone can join, and it's a community. And the fact that the Jewish community has been discriminated and persecuted for thousands of years, I said this in a speech that I gave a few years ago, that we should be all the more so empathetic, and we should welcome people of different races and different into our religion and make them feel even more welcome. And I think there's three ways of doing this. There's the education perspective. Educate people that there are different types of Jews of different colors in the Anglo-Jewry. Educate people, and that can be done through events, be done through articles. Then there's awareness. Make them aware that there are these sorts of people in the community. There are people of color in the community, and these two things I really do believe will lead to the change of behavior. It could even be I walk into a synagogue and someone could make me feel welcome, could say, welcome to our synagogue, instead of staring at me and making me feel like I need to find a seat and I can't concentrate on my prayers because I'm so worried about what people think. It's about just changing the policies of infrastructure. Synagogues should have it at the top of their synagogue leaders should tell their congregants and that they should make people feel welcome instantly, and it should be embedded into the culture. And this is what I would like to change. And I know Philip Rosenberg is doing that as well, which I'm really grateful for.
So Phil, tell us a little bit about some of the work that the Board of Deputies are actually doing surrounding this particular issue.
So over the last year or so, we've been particularly reaching out to different parts of the Black community to kind of have the conversation about what we want to do. In fact, unfortunately, we were due this month to have an event with the Black Cultural Archive in Brixton, but we've postponed that so that we can do it at some other stage. I think that the things we're currently having some more conversations, so I don't want to say absolutely what we're doing, but the three strands that we're thinking of are education. We're trying to take the moment to let the Jewish community know more, and this conversation is very helpful. But we also want to hear from Black Jews, other Black people who've experienced the community, and then work with our institutions to make sure that we can embed learnings and stop Jadesi and others having the experiences that they've had entering their own places of worship.
And just final words to you, Jadesi, because I want you to tell us what you want to see come out of all of this unrest that we are witnessing at the moment.
Yeah, so what I would like to see on a very humble level is I know a lot of other black people who are Jewish in the community who really do feel the same. It's not that one person's making this up. It's just I want people to realise that this is actually an issue and actually a problem that we as a Jewish community we need to get right, as Philip Rosenberg said. We need to get it right. This is not just to have in our community. And what I would like to see is people being more welcomed into synagogues, people being asked less questions, people being representing the community who are of colour and getting out there not feeling that they have to, like even in the dating world, there's a lot of issues as well with being of colour, with people's stories. I want people just to feel part of the community as if it's their home, their family. I would love to walk into a new synagogue. Thank God I'm very involved in the community, but I would love to walk into a new synagogue one day and have no reservations to how I'm going to act or how I'm going to be perceived. That's what I would love to. That's what I would dream of one day, there to be an Anglo Jewry.
Motivational speaker Jodeci Joseph and Phil Rosenberg of the Board of Deputies, thank you both so much for speaking to me about this very difficult subject on the JN podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the JN podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, the truth is out there. The secret has been revealed. Our top 10 for the 40 under 40 have been revealed. And you will find it if you look at your copy of the Jewish News for this week on pages 14 and 15. And amongst those friendly faces that you see there is our next guest. He came in at number 3 on the top 10 list, and we can say hello now to Danny Stone MBE, who is the chief executive of the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust. And Danny, first and foremost, mazel tov, third place, most definitely not to be sniffed at.
Well, yeah, absolutely, thank you very much. I'm honored.
I think we need to first and foremost establish why it is, because I know from reading the article why it is that you're rightly in the list there. But I think that for those who maybe, just maybe, haven't heard of what you do, why not give us a little bit of an insight into the work that you do?
Sure. Well, I should say first, you know, I've been looking at the results over the past few weeks and all the people who've come up, and there are some fabulous people on the list. And the ranking, I very much appreciate the judges, but there are people who are on there who I consider colleagues and equals, who are brilliant in many more ways than me. I think you've done extremely well in picking so many people. In terms of what I do, our charity, the charity I run, is called the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust. And we've existed for more than a decade now, working with decision makers, opinion formers, trying to educate them about anti-Semitism and trying to help them in putting in place the right frameworks to deal with anti-Semitism. And in practice, what does that mean? Well, if you were to look in the Jewish News this week, there's a story about an SNP MP who's been readmitted to the party after doing some education with us. That's what we do. We want to teach people about, you know, where mistakes have been made, what can they learn, how can they understand what they've done. Perhaps they've never met a Jewish person before, perhaps they didn't really understand the context of something they posted, in this case on social media. But it's also working on bits of legislation. The government's going to have an online harms bill coming up, and we want to ensure that our online world is as safe as it can be. So we'll work with parliamentarians and others to try and inform that decision making. So that's what we do.
Well, I mean, I love the way that you said also matter of fact, as if you have just listed some of the easiest tasks the community has to face there. But frankly, it sounds absolutely extraordinary what you have to do. I suppose that sort of the first thing that has to come up is how your involvement came about in all of this. Why was it that you felt it was your responsibility to do something about some of the hideous and offensive anti-Semitism that our community has come up against, and it seems now more than ever?
Well, do you know what? I remember when I was at primary school and I was just a child in the playground, and I remember being told an anti-Semitic joke, and I don't think I understood at the time what it was or the history of it. I just knew it was about me because it was about Jewish people, and it kind of felt wrong. So I've always had a kind of a gut reaction about this stuff. So I've always felt slightly personally drawn in. I spent a year off in Israel. I was very involved in the youth movement. I came back I had a very strong sense of my Jewish identity. And so from the Jewish communal perspective, I've always been involved. I've had that strong identity. I think more broadly, in principle, I'm an anti-racist, and I consider that anti-Semitism has to be dealt with in the same way that I would expect any other form of racism to be dealt with, which is, you know, with zero tolerance.
Absolutely. And I think that one thing I should make absolutely clear is you very flatteringly said earlier on in the interview, you don't know actually was how it was that we chose from the list of nominees. I would like to just declare right here and now that I didn't have any involvement personally with it. So I also have to commend those who did narrow down what is a very impressive list. And if you did want to see the full list, that is on page 13 of the Jewish News for this week. Just finally, because sadly we only have very limited time with you, but I certainly want to get this in. You are obviously a very influential sort of chap. I mean, the fact that you've been awarded an MBE, in fact, if we can shoehorn that in itself, what was it like to find out you did win an MBE, by the way?
It was amazing. My wife got this letter in the post and she thought we were in trouble with the Inland Revenue or something. There was this official stamp, so she thought we were in trouble. And then when we opened it up, it was kind of shock and delight. And it was really quite a remarkable thing. You know, no one really expects to be nominated for something like that, I don't think. And so it was wonderful, really.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a really horrible thing of me to say a by the by, because it's most definitely not a by the by. And I desperately hope that if we speak again in the future with much more time, we'll be able to explore exactly what that was like a little further. But just finally, what I really want to find out is that you've obviously made great strides with the work that you've done, but are now giving you a glimpse into the future. The mark that you've made has already been quite impressive. But what are you going to do moving forward? What can we expect from Danny Stone? And what can we expect from the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust moving forward?
So our huge focus is online anti-Semitism. The way in which people experience anti-Semitism now, you can open up your phone, you look at something, you feel affected by it if you see anti-Semitism online. So certainly in the immediate future, but I think this is going to be a long-term kind of battle. Our work to address anti-Semitism online on social media is huge. We're expecting government to put a regulator for social media in place. We'll be working to make sure that regulator is as strong and as positive and as an impressive organisation as it can be. But beyond that, you know, we want to make sure social media is a safe space for the Jewish community and everyone else. And so that will be the focus for me personally. I mean, fighting anti-Semitism, I think I'm a lifer. I've committed to it. I also have a sideline in writing about wrestling. I've written about wrestling in the Mirror and in the Jewish News, in fact, before. So I think I'll try and continue that as well.
Fantastic. Don't ever change. Keep up what you're doing. And we're all mightily impressed by you, sir. Danny Stone, MBE, position number 3 in the 40 under 40 for the Jewish News. Thank you so much for speaking to me on the JM podcast.
Of course. Thank you.
This is the JN podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, every week here on the JN podcast, we always like to meet during these times of coronavirus, a COVID hero. And this week, we've got not one, but two. Our first hero this week is Katie Icklow, who is among a group who have been honoured for part of a network of volunteers bringing meals to NHS workers across London, and she has been awarded a prestigious Point of Light Award by the PM. Let's find out a little more about this by speaking to Katie herself. Katie, first and foremost, mazel tov. Points of Light is nothing to be sniffed at. I know several people who've won them, and they are real recognition for great work.
Yes, thank you so much. We were thrilled and really honoured to receive it, and quite frankly didn't expect it, so it was a lovely surprise.
So I think that you need to tell people, just because my introduction there only gave a little snippet, a tiny taster, yeah, if you'll forgive the pun, of what you do. What is it that you have done during this time of COVID-19 outbreak?
Basically, from the outset, it was myself and my mum and a very good friend of mine, Sarah, and another very good friend, David. And because of a personal connection with my mum and someone who works at the Northwick Park Hospital, and Sarah, whose sister is a consultant at the Royal Free, we had a real insight into how terrible it was for the conditions for the staff in the hospitals and how difficult it was for them to access food, being that they were in PPE all day long and takes a long time to get kitted up and a longer time to take it off and able to grab something to eat. And we offered to send up some food that we were making ourselves, some chicken soup and some pasta bakes and sandwiches, just so that they could access it very quickly in a side room, if you like, off the ward, rather than having to go and queue in the canteen and get food. And David offered to deliver it for us.
Well, can we look into the delivery of it a little more? Because I think there'll be some people wondering that, first and foremost, it's incredibly admirable that when most people, if they don't have to go anywhere near to hospitals or get involved the fact that you are doing this in itself is amazing. But there will be some who are obviously wondering how it is that you keep safe during all of it. Because obviously, if one doesn't have to go to a hospital at the moment, we try and keep away from
them.
And there is obviously health and hygiene implications.
Kind of what we called inside contacts within the hospitals, the people, the actual staff that we were feeding would give us contact names of medics or admin staff that would come outside and pick up the food from either the car park or the entrance. So there was none of our drivers ever actually went into the hospitals. So it was very well coordinated by having such inside contacts to be able to coordinate the deliveries.
But how does it work logistically speaking, not just about the delivery of food, but actually the coordinating of the making of the food? How do you know how much to make? How do you know who's going to?
Yes, so this is what happened very early on. It went from maybe, I don't know, 30 meals to the Royal Free and 30 meals to Northwick Park, from receiving contacts from other hospitals who were in need, and it growing exponentially on a daily basis. So literally, as we thought we had it sussed, initially enlisted the help of my neighbours who offered to help make sandwiches and pasta bakes. And I would go off to Costco and do a big shop and buy all the ingredients necessary, to being approached by caterers and chefs.
Wow.
We had two Cordon Bleu Michelin star chefs cooking for us, who were obviously not working and bored and at home and wanted to help, which escalated up to us being able to access Mill Hill Private School and use their kitchens. And one of our very good team members, Dan, was able to, he was a head boy there, so he used his contacts and they let us use the kitchens there for about 6 to 8 weeks. So then we could up our production to about 500 meals from just there a day. So we very quickly grew from about 30 a day over about a period of 5 weeks to our maximum, which was 2,200 in one day.
Wow.
So, so my job was coordinating the numbers. So I'd speak to all the contacts at the hospitals. How many do you need? How many on your ward? How many would be useful? Some of them not ordered, but were very grateful to have some that they could hold over in their fridges for the night shift. And some, it all went at lunchtime. And then David coordinated all the delivery drivers. So he had a basic WhatsApp group of people that wanted to volunteer, and he'd do it on a rota system and put the job out there, and whoever came back first grabbed the job and did it.
I can't help but wonder the disappointment on someone's face though, at the NHS staff, that, let's just say for example, someone like me, who I can cook, I'm not an amazing cook, I can do it though, I cook a meal, and then my colleague next to me, sort of maybe at the NHS, receives one of the Cordon Bleu meals versus sort of what they get from me. I can't help but think of the disappointment.
We made sure that there was a very good spread between each hospital of a combination, and also, although they're Cordon Bleu Michelin star chefs, because we were relying on heavy, you know, on funding, they kept it simple, you know, five basic ingredients, very, you know, something that was a healthy, hearty meal with couscous and vegetables, and some were meat and some were vegetarian, some we did vegan, some halal, just to give a variety. You know, they weren't brazen enough to say, well, could we have five vegetarian and 10 meat? And, you know, it was just, they were so grateful for a little, you know, easy meal they could put in the microwave, heat up and eat. So there was a very big mixture, and most of our chefs, the professional chefs and caterers, did keep it relatively simple. So not as to, but we every morning when we pack it up, we do divide it up. We don't get one chef always cooking for one hospital. They get a broad mixture of everything. And when it got a bit hotter, we had some lovely salads. And, you know, when it was colder, a bit of soups with a bread roll, you know. So it was a real mixture, and coordinating it between me sort of saying to the chefs, can you do me 100 next week every day instead of 50? And every time we thought we had it sussed, it would change.
It sounds absolutely fabulous, and it sounds like such an amazing team effort. Really, bravo to you and to all the team. Just very quickly, because out of wild curiosity, where do all the ingredients come from?
So initially it was me going off with a couple of neighbours socially distancing with massive trolleys and getting everything from Costco until we were able to open wholesale accounts with some food suppliers, one very good one in Covent Garden for all the fruit and veg, a lovely meat wholesaler that would provide us with halal meat and beef and stuff for the chefs that wanted to cook with meat, and another sort of wholesaler for all the dried goods and the baking and stuff like that. So, and that's where it really came into play, because it meant each chef could just order their own ingredients and it get delivered to them. It made the logistics a lot easier than dividing it all up on my driveway and divvying it out to them.
Well, Katie, there's absolutely no doubt in our mind that you are a COVID hero. So thank you very much indeed for all
pleasure.
That you have done. Just finally, if someone wants more information, they want to get involved, is there any way they can go to help? Maybe a Facebook group or maybe a website?
That was the main way we were managed to grow this so massively, and great support from all the community. And its Facebook group is called You Donate, We Deliver. So all the information anyone would need would be on there.
Excellent. You donate, we deliver.
We deliver.
And as far as we're concerned, you cook and we look on with admiration. Thank you very much indeed, Katie.
Pleasure. Hitler. Thank you so much.
And mazel tov again on your wonderful Points of Light award.
Thank you so much.
This is the JN podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, from one COVID hero to another. I told you we like to meet at least one on the show each week. We've got two for you this week. We can now find out about phenomenal advances in technology that are being used to help fight against the coronavirus. This is an Israeli-based company called Spark Beyond, who are using AI or artificial intelligence to help in the battle against the coronavirus. And I'm delighted to say we can now speak to Chief Commercial Officer for Spark Beyond, that's Amir Haramati, who joins me now from Israel. Amir, first and foremost, thank you for everything that you and Spark Beyond are doing. This sounds incredibly exciting. Can you give us a bit, first and foremost, of an insight into what Spark Beyond are and what you guys actually do?
Absolutely. Again, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Spark Beyond is an Israeli-based company. You know, I call this company the highest IQ refugee camp in the world. We have refugees from Google, from IBM, from Berkeley, from Stanford, from London School of Economics, etc. We assembled a group, 200 people, which are each one of those guys can easily write his own ticket, but team up to be part of something which is bigger than ourselves. What we actually do, we always joke that those two letters that you just mentioned, A and I, arguably the most used and abused letters in English language at present time. We take those two letters, A and I, and we connect it to a simple thing, which is called impact. So Spark Beyond is a purpose-driven, mission-oriented company that connected our technology to harness humanity's collective intelligence to solve the most complex problems in the world. We started, of course, from a business problem, but we also, while we're taking care of the business impact, we are deeply committed to social impact. So Spark Beyond has been using our technology in addition to the business track in fields like early detection of colon cancer, where we were able to amplify the ability of early detection of colon cancer by 13x, so 13 times, to helping some of the largest consumer packaged goods companies to fight plastic pollution, to team up on climate issues. We were supposed to be a big part of COP26, which was scheduled to take place in Glasgow in October, and now, unfortunately, had to be rescheduled. As we call it in Hebrew, Spark Beyond is a company with neshama yatera. So whatever we do, of course, we use our brain, we use our heart, but mostly we use our soul. And what we do is we have the ability, whenever we deal with any type of problem, we try to understand that before we get the right answer, we must first ask the right question. So what we have done is we build an hypothesis generating engine so we can take any type of data available, run it in brute force in every possible direction, not leave a single stone unturned, and ask millions and tens of millions of questions within seconds, within minutes, within hours, and basically then serve it to the domain expert, not as a black box, but actually as a glass box. Therefore, now the doctor or the domain expert can look inside, understand the drivers, and act upon. A great example, not COVID-19 related, is we team up with one of the largest management consulting company in the world, and we were trying to help them to fight violence in one of the correction facilities in the northeast of the United States, which is very relevant, unfortunately. And the Spark Beyond engine came with recommendation, and we were able to reduce the inmate violence by more than 40%.
Wow.
But simply reassign the inmates in a different way to the cells. So the way we do it, we take the data as is, and we tell our clients, your data, even if it's imperfect or incomplete, it's much more valuable than you think. However, it tells only a small portion of the overall story. So the next thing we do, we connect any external data sources which is relevant, news, weather, Wikipedia, location, Federal Reserve data, census data, social media, or anything else to augment it and extend it. And then now we have a very fast and very deep way to look inside in a way that no human eye can look, combine the dots and connect the dots in a way that no human brain can do it, extend the knowledge to everything which is available in the world, and then serve it as a decision support system that can help you make fast, quick decisions. When COVID-19 came about, we knew that this is a call from the universe. Forget about business aside. It's our job and it's our duty to help in any way, form, or shape that we can do.
Well, let's see. Let's look into how you are, because I'm very aware that we've got very limited time with you, and I really, really want people to learn how it is that your amazing sounding technology has been helping. So what is it that you guys have been doing in a bid to try and fight COVID-19?
Absolutely. And we're talking about three or four different dimensions. The first one was during the contagion. So we wanted to get some, we always say it's not about predicting the future, it's really about shaping the future. So understanding the root cause will allow you to shape it. So what we have done when COVID-19 started to spread quickly, we were able to use our engine to find and generate dynamic heat map to tell you where it's going to get spread next or which areas you should avoid. So in Tel Aviv, for example, we were able to go down to a building level and tell you which street and which buildings you have to avoid and which stores you have to stay away from. Then when Italy became such a terrible hotspot, we were able very quickly to tell them, like, avoid highway A1 because that's an unbelievable spreading aisle of the disease. Stay away from A1. Don't stop in specific gas stations. We were able to work on Singapore, for example, and Singapore, at least initially, felt that they're really managing the situation very well. The numbers were very good. And I got on record on a global webinar about 10 days before that, another spread, and said, we are already starting to identify some new heat pockets around the dormitories of foreign workers. And 10 days later, that's exactly where the outbreak took place. And that's really took Singapore all the way back. And they're still right now recovering from what took place 2 months ago. So we're starting from dynamic mapping and dynamic heat map mapping of the contagion. Very quickly, that evolved to how to manage the lockdown. I'm sure you're facing the same situation right now in the UK. How do you combine the health reason and the health principles with a business and economy? How can you generate this multidisciplinary decision support system? And that's really rolled to the next step. And the next step was we all faced a new reality, which is now called the new normal. An organization all of a sudden realized that all the models of doing business, if it's underwriting or understanding demand forecasting or understanding churn drivers, it's all based on data, which is obsolete. All of a sudden, organization realized that the data they collected in the last 3 months, it's much more valuable than the data they collected in the previous 30 years. So how do you make some sense in this mess? And we have the ability not only to work with data and big data, but we can work also with small data or no data. And still then put on top of it all the external data sources and very quickly find the root causes and then present it to the decision maker as a glass box. So now we're working with one of the largest management consulting company that selected this type of solution to be what they call the operating system to shape the next normal. Now, the last very interesting turn of events happened in the last couple of weeks. We team up with another Israeli technology company doing an incredible work on a Terra frequencies area. And together we find a way to come up with a very quick and reliable test to test negative for COVID-19. Now, one of the biggest challenges we all face right now is the fact that you don't know if the people on the train or the people on the tube or the people on the Heathrow airport or the classroom or the hospital are sick right now. So together right now, we're working on a solution that will allow you to take a very quick and low-cost test that basically every time you step into the hospital, you can take this test and within a minute or seconds, you'll be able to know if you can if you've been tested negative. And if you tested negative, you can step in. And that way, I believe this is going to be an instrumental element in bringing back to business and getting back to the airports and getting back to the tube station or the hospitals or the schools. So we're seeing right now a tremendous movement that using technology and artificial intelligence that really can make a difference, that allow us first to adjust to the next normal and then help us define and shape what's coming up next.
Amir, you have absolutely no idea how I would love to carry on for at least another 10, 15 minutes and then some talking to you about this subject, because I'm personally absolutely fascinated by it. I think what you guys are doing is, never mind Spark Beyond, it's beyond incredible. So thank you so much for speaking to me on this edition of the JM podcast. And thank you so much for everything your company's doing in a bid to try and fight COVID-19.
Thank you so much. Stay safe.
Well, that's nearly all we have time for this episode of the JN podcast. But just before we go, how about that we make room for our new feature here, where each week comedian Ashley Blaker offers us some words of humour and wisdom in what can only be described as very dark and troubling times.
Hello, Ashley Blaker here, back on the Jewish News podcast. And I hope you all had a very good Shavuos, or even a very nice Shavuot, and a slightly nice Pentecost. And I hope you're all well at home, and I'd like you to at least spare a little bit of a thought. I know you've all got stuff to worry about, stuff going on in your own life, but please spare just a little bit of time thinking about me. Because where is your quarantine? Probably sounds like this. Pretty quiet, isn't it? Maybe the TV on or radio on in the background. Sat reading, I don't know. Mine sounds more like this. Now that's because for some reason I have six children aged between 6 and 15. And I think I can safely say it's at a time of national lockdown that having this many young children suddenly feels like it was a very bad idea. Now just to clarify, we're mostly Jews, I would imagine. So, but just in case you don't realise, people in the Orthodox community do tend to have a lot of children. I think it's because when you're not allowed to have a TV in the house, there's not a lot else to do of an evening. There are genuinely friends of mine that keep having children to the point that I no longer know how many they've got. It's actually very similar to the Fast and the Furious movies. You know, you think, they can't still be making them. Surely they've made enough of them by now. But no, every year they knock out another one, and you've got no idea what number it even is anymore. Is it Fast and Furious 8, Fast and Furious 9? One of them was actually called The Fate of the Furious, because even the filmmakers had no idea what number they were up to. So anyway, this is similar, and like the Fast and the Furious movies, the children will cost the people who produce them a small fortune. However, unlike the movies, you've got almost no hope of making your money back. And ironically, when you have that many children in the house, the sex also has to be fast and furious. Well, I'm fast and my wife is furious, so it kind of works. It hasn't been easy with the children, it really hasn't. I mean, we've tried to recreate some of our family trips by just sitting on the driveway in a parked car, making everyone watch wildlife films on an iPad, but even then I can't really tear them away from their own devices. It was actually even worse, of course, during Pesach. Pesach seems like a long time ago now, but I've got to be honest, I'm still recovering from it. You know, it was pretty awful, and it was a blessed relief when it was over. You know, eight of us stuck in the house, unable to get out. It was a blessed relief when we were able to get back to normality. Eight of us stuck in the house, unable to get out. But with bread. By the way, I'm making assumptions here. I'm assuming everyone listening to this is Jewish, knows what Passover is. If not, very quick explanation. Passover, 8-day-long Jewish holiday when we can't eat bread, pizza, pasta, stuff like that. And we mostly have to eat these unleavened matzah crackers, which give you horrific constipation. We're celebrating our freedom from slavery, but become more backed up than the M25. To be honest, I think the rabbis could have made themselves very popular by following the organisers of Wimbledon and the Olympics and just cancelling Passover this year, but there you go, didn't happen. Now, the biggest problem, of course, with having a large family is just with social distancing, because with eight of us in the house, we permanently have a public gathering. And when we go out for one of our daily walks, I get angry reactions from people who think I'm running some kind of rogue school trip. The worst, though, is going to the supermarket, because people get very suspicious when they see how full my shopping trolley is. Someone shouted at me, "Is all that food really necessary?" I said, "Yes, I have 6 children." She went, "6? I said, "Yeah, I know, but we started late." By the way, quick word of warning, if you ever meet another Orthodox Jew, whatever you do, don't ask how many children they have, because lots of them are very superstitious and don't like saying in case it attracts the evil eye. I once made the mistake of asking, and this guy went, more than a 5-a-side, but fewer than a full football team. I had no idea what he was talking about, but I actually now do this myself. If anyone at my synagogue ever asks how many children we have, I always say, more than the Gospels, but fewer than the disciples. They've got no idea. Anyway, these are challenging times with all the children in the house, and I don't have a lot of money at the moment. I'm not touring. So I've had to come up with a radical solution. Okay, so listen, children. Because Daddy isn't earning much money at the moment, we're going to have to furlough 4 of you until the end of this period, at which point we'll hopefully be in a position to welcome you back to the family. Now, do you know what furlough means?
No.
No.
Right, so basically what this means is that the Chancellor of the Exchequer... Do you know who the Chancellor of the Exchequer is?
No.
Okay, well, essentially, Mummy and Daddy can no longer afford to keep you all on as part of the family, so the nice man from the government will pay 80% of your pocket money from now on. You won't be allowed to do any chores, but since you weren't doing them anyway, that's no great loss. So we're allowing 2 of you to stay on. Simmy, what do you bring to the family?
Thank you very much to comedian Ashley Blaker there with some wise words for us during these troubled times. And there you go. That's it for this episode of the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. At this stage, I would like to say thank you to all of our guests, Phil Rosenberg, Jodeci Joseph, Danny Stone, Katie Icklow, Amir Hamarati. Thank you to our paper team, Justin Cohen and Fran Wolfish. And of course, thank you for listening. We must also thank Justin Cohen for producing this episode as well. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll be able to hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we'd featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, then we would love to hear from you. You can email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the JN Podcast. Goodbye.